Hi guys, Pete and Rich here. The Boys in the Band podcast is back. But before we get into the main show, we've just got to tell you about a cool deal from our sponsors, Beer 52.
Yep, they've come up with a great deal for listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. So if you fancy a free case of 8 craft beers from Beer 52, just go to beer52.com/band and all you have to do is cover the postage cost of $5.95.
And as well as that free case, you also get signed up to Beer 52's Beer Club, the largest in the world with over 150,000 active members. And each month, members are sent a case with a different theme, as well as a magazine and a snack. You can, of course, pause or cancel at any time, but it's well worth trying out.
So head over to beer52.com/band for that offer, and we hope you enjoy the upcoming pod. Welcome to another edition of My Naughty's number one album, brought to you by the Boys in the Band podcast. And this week we've got Sim from the 80s Matchbox Beeline Disaster picking out his favourite album from the Naughties. That, of course, follows up the chat we had with Sim at the weekend that came out and went down really well, didn't it, Pete?
Yeah, it did, yeah. And there was a lot of messages that we received saying how much people love seeing 80s Matchbox live back in the day. And yeah, some people calling for a reunion as well, which I don't think was quite on the cards from gauging and reading between the lines from what Sim was saying. But yeah, it was good to get him on and hear that side of the story as well. A band which did things slightly differently, both in terms of the music and their style and the way they approach things, to some of the indie bands which dominated that scene during the 2000s. But they certainly made their own place for themselves and clearly won a lot of fans along the way. And we really enjoyed chatting to Sim about their story. We also grabbed him to pick his favourite album of the Naughties as well. Here's what he went for.
So we're with Sim for the 80s Matchbox Beeline Disaster on My Naughty's number one album. So Sim, what album have you picked out as your favourite from that first decade of the 2000s?
Well, I was thinking about this. I was thinking, Relationship of Command at the Drive-In, because that just sneaks in the year 2000. So yeah, I just remember hearing it. And I think they sort of blew my socks off. I really regret not going and seeing them at the Astoria, actually. I think it was Annual Notice by the Trail of Dead, possibly. Yeah, but I didn't go, so I've never seen them.
Oh, so you mentioned on the main podcast that this band were obviously inspiration for you. What was it about them that sort of got you so excited?
Well, I think, you know, like after that sort of stale backwater of nothing happening in the late 90s, like, you know, particularly over in the UK, like, hearing that band, seeing them on Jules Holland was just like, it was just an amazing kind of energy. And, you know, the two guys in it, you know, Cedric and Omar, just looked absolutely incredible. And it was really inspiring to hear that album. Actually, I just had it on repeat at the time. I've not listened to it in a long time.
Had you been into the band prior to that album? They did a few before then.
Yeah, they did two albums before. Yeah, no, I'd not heard of them. And I've not really listened to any of their albums since, because they broke up after that album, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Cedric went and formed Mars Volta, didn't he?
Which we played with them actually, in 2004, and I really like Mars Volta, but I preferred At the Drive-In. Yeah.
Any standout tracks from that album for you that still stick out?
I don't know. Sort of like the first one, is it Arc Arsenal?
Arc Arsenal. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
That was the first one I heard, so I suppose that will always sort of stick with me. But it's a really good album, like, actually played it, so. Yeah.
Well, voted 12th out of 100 as albums of the decade by NME, so it's, as you say, it's an influential one.
Oh, right. What other albums have people said? I probably don't want to say.
Well, no prizes for guessing that Is This It was number one.
Right.
Yeah. Up the Bracket was number two.
Right.
Exterminator number three, yeah, whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not. Number four, Fever to Tell number five. Yeah, so these are the sort of big iconic albums they've got. And then, there's Relationship of Command number 12. What about the NME, Sim? Were they obviously on board with you guys and helpful to launching you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they. I mean, they wrote about us all the time, and I think there was a group of bands that were in it. It was like a sort of club or something. I don't know. Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, I think that I think the music industry in a way misses like having a go-to magazine, you know, like you had back then, you know. I mean, in lots of ways it's great because there's loads of magazines in the internet, you know, so much information and bloody blah, but like in another way, like, yeah, I think that was kind of, you know, it's quite cool, yeah.
Yeah, important reference point, wasn't it, for people? Yeah. And I guess as you mentioned on the main pod, you guys being slightly different to some of the other bands we've mentioned there in terms of your sound and you look, I guess that probably appealed to them as well. So something a bit different to what else they were writing about.
Yeah, no, it was cool because we got quite a lot of press in Enemy and in Kerrang at the same time because we sort of fitted both, which is good. But yeah, we were definitely like the most out there band, didn't they? Like, I don't think we sounded like anyone else really. Yeah.
Yeah, so you must have been in a pretty select group to sort of have a one foot in each magazine, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Like one magazine, if someone else, do you know what I mean? They wrote about one or the other. Like, you know, so it was kind of, yeah, quite hard to be written about in both, I think. So that was cool.
Nice one, Sim. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining us for the main podcast. Thanks for picking out your favourite album of the noughties and catch up soon.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks so much.
So we have it, Relationship of Command by At The Drive-In. One I wasn't too familiar with, Rich. There's a couple of songs that I know from them, which I can sort of remember getting a bit of airplay back in the day, but it's not one I've dived too deeply into. Yourself?
Yeah, similar. I remember that track, One Arm Scissor, when I saw that on the track list, and that sprung to my memory. But yeah, really interesting, I think, in terms of how they would have quite clearly influenced the 80s Matchbox. They did have to share some similarities and yeah, we spoke to Sim about kind of straddling the two magazines of the time, that the Enemy and Kerrang and At The Drive-In certainly sound more to me like more of the Kerrang bracket of things for me.
Yeah, pretty hardcore stuff, but it's I can remember that video for that song as well. Sort of looks like it's home video footage of various gigs and stuff, and yeah, really cool video. Yeah, but interesting. You mentioned, yeah, obviously straddling Enemy and Kerrang, the two major magazines at the time, and 80s Matchbox did that as well. And wow, I mean, to get the support of one of them would be great. Very few bands got the support of both, just because there was that sort of divide, wasn't there, between the harder stuff in Kerrang and the more poppy, slightly rocky indie in Enemy as well. So if you can get a foot in both camps and get support of both, yeah, you're on your way up.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you mentioned the Mars Volta, didn't you? So Cedric from At The Drive-In formed the Mars Volta, and that's another sort of iconic album cover at the time. I don't know if you remember it, Pete. It's the one with the sort of the gold head sort of on a plate with light beaming out of its mouth. Really sort of definitely one that stuck in my mind over the years.
Yeah, another shout out for good album covers on My Naughties Number One. That seems to be a running theme of this bonus podcast series, doesn't it? But yeah, we talked about these bands straddling both magazines, and I reference there the top 100 greatest albums of the 2000s. That's Enemy's list. If you go over to Kerrang, they've done top 50, so not quite as committed to do the lesser 50, but they've narrowed it down a bit more. And At The Drive-In, number 5 on their list in Kerrang, and they actually describe it as a little quote here, which says, "Well, they call it one of the most important rock records of all time." So high praise indeed for At The Drive-In. Top five, Rich, or all the four above that one? Can you name them?
Well, in Kerrang, blind you, mate. No, definitely don't put me on the spot for that.
No. Well, Linkin Park.
You might want to give me a clue.
Linkin Park at top with Hybrid Theory, and Deftones, White Pony. Queens of the Stone Age, Rated R at number 3. And Marilyn Manson, Hollywood at 4. One, really. Yeah, so a real clear indication of the shift in genre between those two magazines. But as we've said, two magazines with, you know, huge readerships at the time, relatively speaking, and real influence as well. And I thought it was actually interesting, Sim, saying about how it's a shame there's not that reference point at the moment. And I guess you can look at it two ways, can't you, where you've got the sprawling internet where, you know, anyone can set up a blog and have an opinion on a new album and a new piece of work, and, you know, all these different websites which will rate and review all the music that comes out, versus having those one or two magazines which really have such an important say, and you know, record companies will be looking to see what you know, how many stars out of five you might get in the Enemy or whatever, and that obviously indicating how well the album's been received and how well it's gone down, and you know, as you know, knock on effect, how many you're likely to shift. So there's two sides to the argument, where you've got that freedom where more people can have opinion, more diverse, you know, spread of opinions, versus, you know, just a few people in an office block on the South Bank, which is where Enemy used to be, you know, deciding what sells and what doesn't. But then, you know, as a consumer, when you're in tune with what the Enemy likes, and you, and they like what you like, it's an easy place to go to get tips on what to listen to next.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was also very much a case of certainly these bands who were gaining momentum. You could really feel it in the magazines at the time, because they were the coverage they were getting. Whereas, like you say, because you knew where to look at the, in those magazines, you'd have your reference points. Even before, a little bit earlier, I'm thinking of Melody Maker was an influential one just before that sort of went out of business around that time. And Q magazine's obviously gone on for a long time as well. So you got that impression of when, you know, when certain bands were in all of the magazines all at once, you know, you felt that momentum building, that they were, you know, gaining significant following. Whereas now it's, like I say, it's a little bit more spread. And so unless you know where to look, you may well not have any idea sort of how big certain acts are actually getting across the mainstream.
Yeah. And, you know, two other points on that. One would be, I'm sure there's loads of musicians out there who feel they got a rough deal from Enemy and suffered as a result. You know, if you fall out with a key journalist at Enemy, then, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle from there as well, isn't it? But then also just what Enemy is now, obviously online only, and you go to their website, and I think it's, you know, personally, I find it hard to recognize the magazine that I listened to, where are we, sort of 15 years ago, to the website they produce now. It's, you go there and you're as much as likely to read a pop or a hip hop or rap album review or an article about what latest antics a rapper's got up to than you are about, you know, an indie kid in Shoreditch that's just laid down a new EP. And yeah, I think it's a shame, really, that it's lost that character, really. I think it's, you know, because obviously we've talked about this 2000s time as a boom time for indie rock, but Enemy has always sort of championed, you know, guitar music and those type of bands. But now it just seems to have shifted towards just trying to be a home for everything, every, you know, music culture that you can grab that's popular at the time, which, yeah, I'm not quite sure. It feels to me like it's lost its way a little bit, and as a consumer, it feels harder to relate to. But that's just my own opinion. Yeah, and I'm sure they've got to, you know, sell ad spaces around it, and maybe they find that's the best way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. You wonder sort of where the thinking is with that, whether they think that their general consumers' tastes have diversified in that way, or whether they feel that they have to diversify, you know, to gain more consumers, you know, to spread their net further. So, yeah, an interesting one. Be interesting to pick the brains of the powers that be at Enemy to see why they have chosen to go down that route, or if they've kind of just naturally gone down that path.
Well, I guess ultimately the model that they had previously of trying to sell that magazine once a week with just packed with guitar bands obviously didn't work, because they had to shut that down. And, yeah. You know, they can obviously diversify into other areas, which they have done, obviously, as well as the different genres of music, that, you know, loads of movie reviews in there as well, aren't there? So it's just trying to become a bigger catchment than it ever did before.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously because of their online presence still, they do seem to still be that first sort of portal call for us in a lot of ways. But yeah, just say it's a little bit harder to find what you're looking for these days, I think. But yeah, there's still a strong reference point for us. And I thought it was interesting to look at that list of top albums of the decade, some of them that have featured on this feature of ours over recent months, Pete. You know, we've had a few mentions for The Strokes, of course. Who had The Strokes? I think we had, was it Bjorn from Razorlight picked out The Strokes, and Lil Man Tate and The Rifles had Up the Bracket as well, didn't they? Definitely a shout out for Graham from Tokyo Police Club for picking out Fever to Tell by the AAAs. That was one that has snuck into that top five, didn't it, Pete? So, yeah, good shout from him.
Yeah, great album. Absolutely. I was just thinking, Rich, we'll have to pull together our top 10 at some point for one of these bonus podcasts. I think that could be an arduous task of could spend hours and hours, couldn't you, trying to whittle it down.
I think this feature sort of shown how vast that decade was. You know, there's some that have snuck in that I never would have expected. You know, we had Stand on the Shoulders of Giants being picked by Oasis recently, and even in that NME list, Primal Scream's Exterminator, you know, both albums, you know, I just wouldn't have really picked as thinking that they came out in that decade, but they just snuck in, didn't they, in the year 2000, I think, both of those.
Yeah, lots to choose from, certainly, and it'd be interesting to see. Yeah, it'd be an interesting project to do, to pull together. Maybe when we get a day off or something like that, we can go and find a nice pub and grab a few beers and get the old pen and paper out and try and work this out.
See how many arguments we have.
Yeah, that could be the end of it. That could be the end of the podcast. A bitter falling out over who's number 17 in our top 100 albums.
Sounds like a good day, mate.
Good stuff. All right, cool. Well, I hope you enjoyed Sim Selection. Go and give it a listen and remind yourself of At the Drive-In and what they brought to the scene. And we'll catch you next time.